Welcome to the Maintainable Software Podcast, where we explore the art of improving existing software with seasoned practitioners who have helped organizations overcome the problems often associated with technical debt and legacy code. I'm your host, Robbie Russell. On this episode, Martin MD, who is a software engineer and currently the director of open source at Ruby Central. Martin joins us from the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California in the United States. Martin MD, we're so glad to have you join us on Maintainable. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Robbie.
So as you reflect on your experience in the industry, what do you believe are a few common characteristics of, dare I say, well-maintained software?
I've been thinking about that and what it means to be maintainable or maintained software. And you can have, say, really poorly designed software that's really difficult to maintain, and you can still maintain it. But I think what we're really asking about is, like, what makes something nice to maintain? What makes it easy to maintain? When you need to make fixes to it, when you need to make changes because something in the world has shifted, in the world moves, and you need to, say, deal with a security vulnerability or update to a new version, how easy is it to do that update? I think that's what we mean by maintainable. And so then what I come back to for maintainable is software that is tolerant to change. And that means that you're not afraid to change it. You can go do the work on the code and you don't have to feel afraid that you're going to break everybody using it, everybody that's relying on it. And I think maybe tests is the critical piece there. That's what it is, being able to say that my code is well tested, that I can feel confident about it.
I like the phrasing around, you know, tolerant to change. Can you give me some examples of, like, things that you've seen that were tolerant or maybe the opposite, maybe like an opposite of that?
Okay, yeah. So, like, a good example might be something I worked on RubyGems a lot lately. And in RubyGems, you have a lot of things in the world that are changing around you. You have new security expectations or new maybe vulnerabilities that are found. And so, or like a really simple one is, like, there are other systems that want to be able to serve RubyGems and the same client needs to be able to talk to them. And so we run into a situation where, well, this client doesn't, or this server doesn't serve up the gems exactly the same way. And so then you go and look at the client in the code. You say, what is Bundler doing here? And when you look at that code, and I just had this experience, it was like, this code has been patched and fixed and modified, and there's little if statements and little catches and little things that clearly this is tacked on and patched and modified a bunch, and there's no really cohesive way to read it. And so when you go to work on a piece of software like that, you need to make some small change, and it takes you, say, 3 hours just to understand what that code is doing. I think that's when you could arguably say it's not very tolerant to change. It's not very easy to go in and make this fix. So whereas something that from the outset you go, that should be easy to do. Like, conceptually, that's not hard. And when the code itself doesn't match that expectation, you go in and look at it and you're like, well, I thought this wouldn't be hard, and it is. And so I had the experience of working on a system or working on a piece of it just like this, where it's you go in and you spend most of your time just trying to understand it.
And is that more of a, like, when you go through and try to get context, do you feel like is enough of the context just in the code itself and maybe the automated test? Or do you find that you have to often, maybe in that type of scenario where you're working on open source projects like RubyGems and Bundler, that there's enough context in the code itself? Or do you have to find, like, yourself going back through the archives of some GitHub issues or what have you?
Yeah. I think this is actually, like, it's a really good model case, because in this situation, the tests around Bundler are, like, really thorough. So when we go to look at, does the code do what it's supposed to right now? And do we feel confident about it? Like, we can feel pretty confident that it is doing the right thing right now. And yet the code, because it has been modified carefully, surgically, over and over again to do the right thing, it's not really very pretty or readable. And I think that's just the nature of it. I think any long-lived project is going to have this sort of surgically fixed changes that aren't necessarily in the right spot. Like, if somebody were to design this from the outset, they wouldn't have designed it that way. But when it came time to fix it, here's the easiest place to make the fix. And so you get a lot of like repeatedly, here's the easiest place to make the fix. But then I think what is like a defining characteristic of a well-maintained piece of software like Bundler or Ruby Gems, compared to like other stuff I worked on at companies where it, you know, maybe the same level of care hasn't been taken, is that the test suites are like extremely thorough. So you have just like recorded responses from the servers that you can rely on that are like for each of these different cases, because every time somebody ran into a bug, they added a case for it. So you end up with a very thorough set of tests that allows you to feel confident that in this case, I ended up refactoring that piece of code very, very carefully, mind you, because it doesn't, just because it's well tested doesn't mean everything's covered. But when you go in and you refactor a piece of code like that and you have these tests and you see that if you make a slight mistake here or there, a test fails, that's really reassuring. And so I think it gets back to the idea that I'm not afraid to make these changes. And whether or not the code is beautiful, I think doesn't have as much to do with its maintainability as whether you can do it and feel confident about it. Just that not feeling scared to make the change makes a big difference in maintainability.
I get that. What do you consider to be technical debt? How do you define that at this point in your career?
Yeah. Oh, and I like that you say in this point in your career, because that's definitely changed over my life. I used to think of technical debt almost like the stuff I'm not being allowed to work on. Like, the company wants me to work on these features and I'm not being allowed to work on the stuff that actually needs to happen. It's all this structure isn't right, this thing isn't right. And my impression of that has evolved over time. And I think where I'm at right now, I don't think this is going to be stable forever, but where I'm at right now is that technical debt is sort of a thing that you can purposely do to get things done more quickly. Something that means it's the surgical change like I was talking about. I can go in right here. I know this change will fix it. It's not beautiful, but I can do it right now. And then whereas I used to think we should spend a bunch of time working on technical debt, now I'm kind of the opinion that technical debt is only worth paying down if it's slowing you down. Like if it's actually having an impact on your ability to fix things. And we could talk about like the way in which companies, I think, can get mired in it, or they can start to do something like a rewrite because of it. And those decisions have huge impacts.
You know, do you think that, you know, you've reflected back on earlier in your career, did you find that it was more difficult then than it is now to maybe convey stakeholders or to get some buy-in that you can address these things? Or do you feel like you've just benefited from, or maybe it was always a little easier just to do it and ask for forgiveness later type of situation? Like, what have you seen work well for kind of raising those things? And if you, for the listeners, for our listeners, if you have any advice on like how to maybe better describe things if they're in that situation, like, you're not letting me take care of these things, that'll just make our lives easier as software engineers.
Yeah, I think my old approach would be, I was definitely like, I'm going to complain about this, you know, and just say, oh, it's so broken, it's so bad. And I don't think I did. I think that I probably did a lot of that. Like you said, I would just make the changes. And, you know, ultimately, you're working on a feature and you run into technical debt, and it's easy to think, I'll just like mix this technical debt fix into the feature that I'm working on. And I think that does happen a lot. Like, I'll do this fix and then I'll do the feature. And I think maybe that, you know, that's still a lot of the way that I end up approaching things, is like you go in to work on something and you almost want to like ready the foundation first. So a lot of the time, I think maybe the best time to tackle the technical debt is when you go to add something onto it. You start out like, well, let's level everything a little bit better. Let's make a commit where I don't change anything. I don't add any features. I just set up what I'm about to do so that it's going to be easier. So everything is always two pieces. It's the level it and then make the commit that does the feature. But as far as like selling it, though, I do think that there's something there, like to convince somebody that it's worth doing these things. When you have something that's slowing you down repeatedly, I think that makes a very good case. I think when you can say, every time I go to work on this piece of software, especially if it's like, I'm afraid to work on it. I'm afraid to modify this. And I've seen this at almost every place I've worked. There's a piece of software people are afraid of. There's some piece of code that nobody will touch. And those are also tend to be really critical systems, like the billing system or the subscription, you know, just something that is critical to the company functioning, and therefore people are afraid of it. And so convincing somebody that it's worth taking the time to make that less scary, I think that's worth doing. And it also makes a good case. We depend on the software and we're afraid to modify it.
When those pieces of software become, so say, mission critical, I'm kind of air quoting that, they tend to get, there's a lot of complexity baked into those things. And they probably didn't start out that way. I would imagine those things are just like bit by bit added, unless it was some crazy genius that did it all from day one. And it just, I mean, the first version of it was just perfect. But I don't know if that's been what I've encountered. What's been kind of your experience there? Is that, how does that kind of manifest?
The crazy genius is a scary idea. I tend to think that anybody that thinks that they can write a project correctly from scratch the first time is maybe just arrogant. Maybe they're just a little bit too sure of their own capabilities. But yes, maybe that has happened. Maybe I've never seen it. I think that the only real way to approach complexity is to make attempts at it. Like, I think you have to start. Like, you have to sort of like draw the broad stroke of what you're trying to accomplish. So these systems that start out, I think every system starts out with somebody saying, aha, I think I know how to make this. I've thought about it. I've designed it. I've put together, you know, some diagrams, some things. I think I understand what I need to do. And so you always start out with at least something that's kind of beautiful, something sort of elegant. You're excited about doing it and you make it cohesive. And since you're starting fresh, you kind of have like a little bit of time to make it happen. But I just don't think humans can know, like, you cannot actually know what your system actually needs to do. Like, it's too much. It's too complicated. And it's so, like, that complexity must show up at some point. So if you're doing anything that's non-trivial, if you're doing anything interesting, then it will become complex, because complexity is just inherent in things that we do. So I think it is just inevitable that projects end up full of this complexity. And so then it's really just a matter, it's like a question of how do we make sure that that complexity doesn't get out of hand. And I don't think it's by having some well-designed thing up ahead of time that sets you up for success. But I don't think that not planning is also, I don't think that that, like, I think you and I have both been in Ruby on Rails for a long time. And what I think stands out about Rails as a framework is that it gives you a consistent set of organization, like a way to organize so that even though your project may get really complex, and it's almost certainly going to, it's not going to be like a mess at the same time. It's going to be like sectioned off in this way, and somebody else will be able to come and look at it and at least have some ability to organize their thinking around how do I approach these problems.
Hey folks, it's me, Robbie. I want you to take a moment and close your eyes. Now picture your code and your applications as a symphony. Now to keep that symphony playing smoothly, you need an orchestra of tools. That's where our podcast sponsor, AppSignal, takes center stage. They combine the elegance of error tracking, the precision of performance monitoring, and the harmony of logging into one symphonic suite. Whether you're composing with Ruby, jamming with Elixir, orchestrating with Node.js, or harmonizing with Python, or maybe even a little bit of flourish of JavaScript, AppSignal's got the sheet music for you. And here's the crescendo. Plans start at just $23 US a month. That's got to be music to your budget's ears. Plus, they're certified ISO 27001, and they dance the GDPR and HIPAA compliance beats. So don't miss a beat, my friends. Head on over to appsignal.com and tell them that your good friend Robbie from Maintainable sent you. Now, open your eyes and let the symphony of smooth coding begin. Let's get back to our show. That's true, and that is one of the reasons I really embraced Rails early on. It was just like, I don't have to make all these decisions. I didn't even know that those were decisions I didn't like making. It was just like an aha moment of like, oh, right, this makes sense. And I don't have to like think about so many little decisions that were just kind of baked into the framework from day one. And like, it just changed the landscape of the software industry. And I think a lot of people don't recognize that now, because almost every programming language has multiple frameworks and they have like some consistency. And so that's a lot more widely adopted as an approach now, as far as I know as a software developer. But again, I don't venture too far out. But yeah, I agree. I can jump in any Rails project and know where I should be able to expect to find things. And there could be definitely some dragons and weird areas of things and complexity there. But at least I can kind of get a sense like, okay, over here there's a thing we got to figure out. But the rest of the app, I can kind of navigate and figure out what we can do in the meantime and not just get like lost in this abyss of spaghetti code or something, which is the world we probably both lived in, I'm assuming, prior to like getting introduced to Ruby on Rails back in the day.
Yeah, you can even see the way in which this consistent organization has improved security, for example. So something that I'm involved with a lot is responding to vulnerability reports. And this interesting thing I've noticed is that there's these scans that look for things that might be hidden in your server. You know, like they're trying to find secret things that you didn't want exposed. And most of those are things because of the way that PHP, for example, which is what I used before Rails, was sort of just, you just throw the files up there. And so then it made it really easy for you to accidentally expose something because you have a file that you didn't really intend to be public, but everything's just, there's no organization, there's no structure that's given that like guarantees that you're not exposing any files over in your app code. You're only exposing files that are meant to be exposed, and it's processing them in a way that you can kind of feel confident. So there's this whole class of vulnerabilities that we're not vulnerable to when we have a good organization.
What are some challenges that you've encountered when working on legacy code, specifically in the open source world?
So in the open source world, I think RubyGems, depending on when you start counting, whether it was like the first commit or the first release, RubyGems is around 20 years old now.
Before we get too far, since not everybody listening is a Ruby and Rails developer, what is RubyGems and what is Bundler for those that might not be familiar?
So RubyGems is the packaging ecosystem for the Ruby programming language. So when you want to publish a library and share it to people, almost everybody in Ruby uses RubyGems. It's the most popular way to share libraries on Ruby. Yeah, so as we approach 20 years of RubyGems, there's certainly a lot of legacy in there. There's things like processors for the old format of what a gem used to look like. And so I think, you know, when you're dealing with like legacy code like this, I come to it with a lot of reverence almost. Like, I really respect this code because this code is no joke. This code is serving billions and billions of requests every month. And so like, it's such heavily used code that you sort of have to believe that everything, even the parts that seem hard to read or ugly or any of that, it's all doing something real. And so when you go to work on this code, I feel like there's an experience that doesn't happen unless you're contributing to open source, which is that the level of extra scrutiny and the standards of the code that you contribute is much, you just get an extra layer of examination. And the people who are taking care of these projects, you know, they're really invested in things like, let's make sure that this is really readable for other people. It's like an acknowledgement that I'm not going to be the one who's always maintaining this. I'm not going to be here. So you write your code as if somebody else is probably going to be maintaining it. And that is definitely different than my experience at when you're writing an app for a smaller company. It's like, it's probably going to be one of the three of us for a little while, and then, you know, maybe somebody else will come on. Whereas with RubyGems, you're like, RubyGems is probably going to exist for another 20 years. Like, certainly. I don't see how it couldn't. RubyGems has been growing year over year at a 20 to 25% rate for the last decade. And so it's not going away. So that means we really do need to think, well, what will this code be doing in 20 years? Are we writing code that can actually live? Are we adding features, or are we? We don't want to burden ourselves with a feature, for example, that we're going to have to maintain, that's going to be difficult to maintain in the future.
Out of curiosity, that 20, 25% increase each year, is that on the volume of requests that the systems, or the number of gems, or kind of a combination of all those things?
I guess like the volume of gem downloads is, I think, what I've been looking at for that. So like the number of downloads of gems. So because we have this tracker on the rubygems.org site where it's just tracking how many gems have been downloaded. And that number is not only, you know, it's increasing at a rate that is increasing. So we're going up by more as we progress. So each month is a larger set of downloads than the last month.
You know, I'm curious about that particular metric because I wonder how often gems are, like, using gems or just any libraries, it could be NPM libraries, and we always see numbers like that and being talked about. And these are, like, legitimate downloads, so this is data transfer that's happening. How much of that is happening from CI builds, you know, just automated tests, you know, things that people are spinning up and they're not caching their libraries between each build and... I'm like, this sounds like, to me, it seems like an interesting problem that we're like, wow, we're like exponentially growing the number. I assume, I don't know if that's actually true, but it's a gut instinct tells me that like a lot of that might be like computers doing it, not necessarily humans intentionally. Like, no, it's time to download some new gems. Do you think about that? And like, how is that something that...
Yeah, well, it's interesting too, because it would inform your strategy. Like in a way, it's cool to say how Ruby Gems has grown. But at the same time, it might be like, well, gosh, where are we going to like continue to, you know, fund and source this? Because if it's purely like large customers re-downloading gems over and over and over again, then that's actually more of a problem than it is like a thing to brag about. It's like, we need to start caching. We actually had a real situation like this where it was like, there's a company that's just, there's some set of IPs that are just hammering Ruby Gems. And it's like compromising the stability of Ruby Gems to stay up. You know, like our sponsored Edge Cash Fastly is like reaching out to us and being like, why have we can see a slight blip in our traffic, and it's from you guys. You know, for us, we're still a blip. Fastly's massive. And so then in that case, the solution actually is to proxy, to like, you know, they can take load off of rubygems.org and they don't mind, you know, for them, they cache the gems and they fetch from us when the caches expire, and works really well for them. It's a great solution.
I'm curious because I don't know enough about the internals of Ruby Gems, but like when you're running like a, you know, bundle install in your, you know, in your Rails app or your Ruby project, and if it's doing some sort of API call, I'm assuming, with and setting up some data, and it's like, okay, give me all the dependencies for each of these gems, and so we can build up some sort of mapping, or I guess I can also look at your lock file, or no, builds a lock file after, anyways. But as it does that, are those requests cacheable as well? Because if you can send, like, I have 30 gems, specific versions, and then the cache can be responded. So the next time that gets called, in theory, it's coming from a cache response.
Yeah, that's actually, well, it's really interesting because that's the part that I was kind of talking about earlier, but didn't really get into. So like the actual process of like checking with rubygems.org to see if I have the newest gems. So like, what is the latest version of this and what are its requirements? Being able to do that quickly, I think we have, and I can't say for the entire background of Ruby Gems, but at least there are three current different ways to access Ruby Gems and ask what are the newest versions. And we're right now, the newest version is, we call it the compact index. And so this is the piece of code I was working on, is fetching the compact index files. And they're just files that list the versions, their hashes, and any important like attributes about them so that we can build them. So there's like one big index file that says, what are all the gems? And then there's one for each gem that says, what are all its versions? And so when you're working on this, one of the scary and also exciting things about it is that you're working on a piece of code that is just running. Like each request can be hundreds of times of accessing the server. And so we do things like, to speed this up, we cache every one of those files that gives the information about the versions. And then we don't even just cache and then if it expires, fetch it again. We do partial requests. So if we say, I have from byte 0 to byte 340, are there any other bytes on this file? And if the server responds, yes, I have these 20 extra bytes, here you go, add this onto the file. And then we append to the file, and then we check its checksum. We say, did it match up with what we should have gotten? And if it does, then we're like, cool, we got an updated file. So that's what makes, for example, resolving the gem file really fast. And that made a dramatic speed up in how fast we can resolve the gem file. And the cool thing is that those files are also cacheable. We don't have to generate them on the fly. So that's the other side. The side you don't see is that rubygems.org is really interested in having files that are cached that can be served by Fastly. And Fastly handles that partial response, the range response caching. So the flip side of, like, on the client side, we want to not fetch gems we don't need. We don't want to do a lot of extra requests. And on the server side, we want to generate as few dynamic responses as possible. We want Fastly to be handling it and doing it quickly. And yeah, we do the same thing with the actual gems, the files. They can't be partial downloaded, but we do the same sort of thing where we have a gem cache that's on everyone's computer, and we try to, you know, we ensure each time that a gem comes down. Like if we say, I need this gem, I'm going to install it. This one, it's here on the computer. We always say, well, is it exactly the same gem? Does the checksum compute to be the same gem? Okay, quick, we can trust this gem. The checksum matches what RubyGems authoritative checksum says. So we will install it. And so a lot of the time this means it's pretty optimized, but getting back to like working on that code, what that felt like is like, if I make a tiny little mistake in the caching, then we cause every Ruby developer in the entire world who upgrades to the next version of Bundler to have their caches all busted, and then they all hammer Ruby gems as soon as the update comes in. And so you have this interesting, like, I better feel pretty good that this code is still caching in the same way and is able to reconstruct and refetch in the same way, so we don't suddenly DDoS ourselves from every Bundler user upgrading and installing.
And out of curiosity, like, how much of that percentage of you going through that process of going through, say, like a Bundler upgrade is stuff that you can completely rely on the automated test suite itself versus maybe you needing to do a couple of manual things for some spot checks yourself?
Our tests are pretty good, and I've learned that, you know, we can rely on them, but I don't think that alleviates the need to manually check, especially on something like this, where one of the things that we did a few times for this like compact index client update is use the old Bundler, run it, look at the files that are generated, go back through and run the like detailed debug logged request to update and say, did we do the partial request? Because, you know, when you're running it locally, or when you're even most of the time, you can't quite tell the difference between like the cache request and a like refetched request, because they're still small files. So it's rubygems.org that notices that. It's not the individual client. So most people, when you're running it, you have to run it in that detailed mode to double check that, like, yes, the assumptions, because ultimately what we changed in this was, how do we checksum those files? How do we say what the file should be and then check if we got the same file that we thought? And when we change the way that we're checksumming, I don't want to get too detailed in it, but it's like the E tag used to be the checksum. So we would both send the E tag as like, here's the information about when this page is stale. But then as a side effect, instead of it being an opaque E tag, which is sort of the common way, it was also a checksum. So we would then compute the checksum and compare it with the E tag. And we decided, we had a need, there was another gem server that didn't do that for E tags. It did not provide computed checksums for E tags. And so that meant it was having the experience like we were talking about, where every request is not cached because the E tags always don't match. And so for them, they were running into this, like, why is it so slow all the time? Why is it refetching all the time? Every one of them, it's never hitting any caches. So, but yeah, when you change that little precise piece, it's like you really want to go through and manually test a few times. And we do the same thing with, like, I'd say all the deploys, we trust our tests, but then we double check. Like for major changes, for small changes, you can be pretty confident. But for anything that's like, this is changing the way something works, you know, you pop into our staging, you go in somewhere and you check that you can still, you know, push a gem. Does the ingestion still work? Can we still receive gem pushes? So yeah, just that extra step of care, because the pain of having to fix when something goes wrong on RubyGems is not worth not doing that check.
How long has it been since you've last needed to quickly release a subsequent fix version of something like Bundler?
Yeah, I think that happens all the time, actually. And I think luckily we're at the place where this project is old enough and stable enough that usually we don't just like break some major thing, but it is pretty common that, for example, Homebrew is all written in Ruby and it relies on Bundler and uses Bundler for their internal system for the people who work on Homebrew to build the Homebrew code. And so for anybody who doesn't know, Homebrew is the Mac package installer for, you know, apps that you might natively install on your Mac, not just Ruby projects. And I'm fairly certain that we recently broke something for the Homebrew developers. And so that sort of thing does happen where it's like they're doing things that most people don't necessarily do. So we don't end up breaking like millions of people, but it's like we'll break a couple core people who then come back and be like, hey, I think this version just broke this. And so as a way to quantify that, when Ruby 3.3 was released, they bundle a version of Ruby Gems with Ruby. So Ruby Gems ships as a part of Ruby. And so we, and I think this is kind of, I don't know if it's cute. I always liked it. So Ruby releases their new versions on Christmas every year. And so for us in Ruby Gems, we're taking the whole like month before, the month of December or so, is getting Ruby Gems and Bundler ready to be shipped with Ruby. And so I think we released 3.5 and 2.5 of Ruby Gems and Bundler. And I think we were at 3.53 and 2.53 before we hit the like, it's ready to go into Ruby.
We'll be back with our interview with Martin in just a moment. Hi, it's me, Robbie. I wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for making time to listen to the Maintainable Software Podcast. If you're finding these conversations valuable, please stop everything you're doing and pop over to Apple Podcasts and help spread the word. Write a review. Give me 4 stars. Give me 3 stars. Saying that interview with Martin was just fantastic. One of my favorite conversations I've ever heard. Or Robbie's an okay host. 2 stars. I don't care. Just be honest, but give us a rating. You can also do that, I think, on Spotify now. And maybe post a link to one of your favorite episodes on LinkedIn or social media, Mastodon, Threads, or wherever you kids are hanging out these days. And now, back to our interview with Martin, MD. Give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about Ruby Central for our audience. So given that not all of our listeners are part of the Ruby community, what is Ruby Central?
Yeah, so Ruby Central is, I would say, an advocate for the Ruby community as a whole. That's the mission of Ruby Central, is really around supporting Ruby. And through that, they do things like put on the annual RubyConf and RailsConf. And that was actually the first conference I ever went to, was RubyConf, put on by Ruby Central. And so they have a mission of supporting just Ruby in general. And about 2 years ago, they merged with an organization called Ruby Together. And Ruby Together had a sort of the open source mission of supporting Ruby Gems and Bundler and keeping that software running. And because like the interesting thing you don't think about, like most code, most open source projects, they're sort of, there's the maintenance cost and the, you have to make the code and then you have to respond with fixes. Ruby Gems is a little unique in that we also have to serve it. You know, like there is a constant cost to keeping the lights on. When Ruby Together was formed, and then when Ruby Together and Ruby Central merged under the Ruby Central idea, it was really about supporting this critical piece of infrastructure for the Ruby community. And so we're really thinking now about how Ruby Central can support the larger community and make Ruby just like a very reliable, very consistent, very serious and secure ecosystem that you can trust, that sets up companies, sets up individuals, hobbyists for being able to work on this programming language that we love.
What kind of help does Ruby Central projects need outside of maybe funding and sponsorships from companies? So for those listening, ask your employers to consider contributing. But beyond that,
yeah, Ruby Central. So we get a lot of different sources of funding. There's a lot of people who I really appreciate that chip in a little bit to Ruby Central just to help us do this development. And then we get grants from some larger organizations that support us. And then, you know, one of the things that I think is most helpful that, like, if you don't have money to give or you can't convince your company to, then, like, take some time and, like, look at what's going on in some of the projects that you care about, the ones that you use. And maybe there are, like, this is an interesting that I see is that there's a lot of times a lot of issues sitting on projects. Like, there'll be open source projects with a bunch of open GitHub issues. And if you also run into those issues, there's no, I would encourage you to, like, take a look at if you could solve it. Like, these projects, these open source projects really rely on people coming to contribute. And it's one of, like, the most, I would say, almost like wholesome, exciting, fun things about Ruby Gems is when people come in and just open a pull request and you just see, like, hey, I fixed this little thing. And you're like, awesome. Like, it's so cool to have people come in and contribute. And so I see that, like, across all of the tools you use, whether you're Ruby or not, just, like, go and seek out these tools that you use and that you like. And if you've invested some time in learning it on the using it side, you might be in a really good position to help out that project. And I think Ruby Central is also really interested in looking for how we can support that. So I think one of my hopes for Ruby Central is that we will start to be able to support projects that don't have enough people with time to work on them, so that we can help get things merged, help get fixes out. You know, some of those things that drive you crazy when you make a fix or there is a fix that needs to happen and nobody's there. I would love to be able to help people be there.
How many different repositories and things are kind of under the umbrella of Ruby Central? And where's that kind of distinction between, is it just like an open source Ruby project versus, you know, like Bundler versus and Ruby Gems? And, like, is it anything under the Ruby Gems organization, or is there a Ruby Central area that we can find?
Oh yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think we're trying to, so there is, like, the Ruby Gems org in GitHub and a lot of the projects that we run, but that's, like, really constrained to what it is to run Bundler and Ruby Gems. So there's the Rails app that is rubygems.org, and there's the code that is Ruby Gems and Bundler, and they're just in one repository under Ruby Gems. And I think, like, overall, we're looking at how we can, I don't want to say pull people under umbrella, because I think what one of the things that makes Ruby unique is that it's a very decentralized ecosystem. Everybody is, you know, working together, but not under, like, one coordinated ecosystem. Something like you'd see in Python. Python is all fairly centralized, that the language, the packaging, you know, PyPI, that's all, like, under the Python Foundation. And so Ruby is somewhat unique in that world, that we don't tend to umbrella things. We don't say, oh, we're everything, we do all of it. And so, but, like, finding ways to, without adding, like, we don't want to control the project, but we would love to provide the, I would love to figure out how Ruby Central can fund smaller projects and, like, bring the funding in and then fund these things. Like, like, one of the things that caught me is, like, RSpec. Like, I feel like I've used all RSpec most of my career, and I kind of love using it. Like, there's other testing libraries, but RSpec's really fun, and I want to make sure that RSpec continues and is maintained and is taken care of. And so, like, that's just, like, a personal example for me. I would love to see these projects continue to live and to be useful and have people enjoy using them.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of those projects have gotten to be where they are, maybe not necessarily directly because of funding. And yet we sometimes talk about how we think funding is the answer to keep it going. What do you feel like has shifted? Or is it just that because it's now more complicated, so it's maybe a harder barrier for the people that maybe were motivated to start the projects are not always necessarily the same people that want to maintain it 15 to 20 years later? Or is it a combination of all of the above?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it too, because I think it kind of wraps us around to maintainability. I think that ultimately you start to get to this point where the project doesn't, you don't know what exactly you would love to throw into the project right now. And so you end up just doing fixes. You're ending up in maintenance. You know, you're just maintaining the project. And so it's like you have people who were willing to freely contribute to this project for a while. And I think at some point you just reach a point where you almost, you almost need to incentivize them to take care of the project because maybe you're just a little tired. Maybe you need to find somebody who is willing to do it. I think it is an actual difficult burden to take your time out of your day to maintain a project. And so maybe one of the answers is like, I started this when I was a single guy and I was just working and programming all the time. And now I'm married and I have kids and I just don't have enough time to work on this. You know, like that sort of thing could be the answer for a lot. It's just like real human stuff that happens to things that the maintainer just can't do it anymore. And so like Ruby Gems has an adoption system within it, which allows people to say like, I can't maintain this project anymore. Is there anybody who'd like to adopt it? And so we tried to build in this system of like offering gems up for adoption. And I don't know necessarily how much it gets used, but it's one of the ways in which projects can be passed on. And so finding people who are interested in taking over something and passing on that maintenance is like probably it's always a challenge within open source maintenance to like continue to keep something maintained over the long term and find people who will take over for you when you can't do it as much.
So as someone who created an open source project many years ago, I definitely relate to that. Like the first couple of years, super energized, working on things. And then it was just like, all right, I have other priorities in my life. I have other projects going on. And eventually people started bringing other people in to help me maintain it and they can continue doing it. And then I get these like bursts of energy to want to sweep back in and help out and do some more stuff. And then for like 4 months later, I'm like, oh, I haven't touched the project in months. And I like that kind of flexibility and freedom and being an open source, but also not wanting to get too detached from the projects. I know that in Ruby Gems, I've seen the adoption or the adopt a gem stuff in there. And so I'll include links to that for people that might be curious about trying to adopt a gem or something or want to get more involved. But you don't have to only look for those projects as well. I'm curious if you mentioned earlier, we had talked a little bit of how software things will just become complex over time. And you know, there's also that burden of maintenance and maybe trying to find ways to incentivize people to come in and work on now what is now probably a much more complicated thing than it was when it was first released. Do you have any advice for people on how to overcome that if they're like, I want to get involved, but it might be a lot more complicated now and maybe my skill set's not where the person that created it. So there's a little bit of that, I wouldn't say imposter syndrome, but something of that. Like I'm not, like the person that made RSpec must be way smarter than me as a programmer, right? And I can just say as someone that created OMI Z Shell, I know very little about Z Shell or about Z Shell itself. And that's the secret there. But the, what's your take on like how to help people kind of overcome that and dive in?
Yeah, I definitely experienced that. I know exactly what you mean. When I started getting involved in Ruby Gems, felt completely out of my element. I was like, how am I supposed to work on this? It just seemed kind of crazy. Just because I'd never done anything like that. And I think that what ultimately happens is that when there's an investment involved, which is that you set aside a little bit of time to figure it out. If there's a problem that's bugging you enough that you want to solve it, and I can feel pretty confident in saying OMI Z Shell was the result of a frustration that you felt and that you spent a bunch of time on it because it made your life better. And it made my life better, honestly, too. I'm using it right now. And I'm like, I've had Robbie Russell as my theme for like the last, 10 plus years. So I see your name more often than you would expect. But, I think the most important thing. So like I talked about this high standard that is there, and instead of that high standard being something you should be afraid of because you don't think you can meet it, that high standard is there to make you better. And I think working on it has made me a better programmer. And you go like, gosh, I've been programming for 20 years and like I now become a better programmer. It sounds like that shouldn't be happening, but no, we're learning all the time. Like programmers are just constantly learning. Like we're spending most of our time learning. I feel like it's rare that I'm spending my time writing code I just fully understand already and can just crank out. That's just not the common case. I'm like learning about caching and I'm learning about e-tags. I'm learning about how do we do this thing? How do we do this thing here in this specific case? I've seen people come to Ruby Gems and they just say, I want to contribute. What can I do? And, you know, a lot of projects do this. We try to mark issues that are good first time issues. They're things that really might only take one of us an hour or two. And yet we've got other stuff going on and these aren't like critical to fix right now. And so we leave them for people who might come along. So that's one good way is to just look for those good first time issues. And then the other situation is you can just look at a part of the project that you maybe already understand from the outside and then read how it works. Here's this API endpoint. What does it actually do? Here's this command that I run in Bundler. What does it actually do? And I will warn you, Bundler's a little complicated. It took me a little bit of time, but so that's not like the perfect example because Bundler took me the most time of any of the projects to understand. Like I never would have thought that I would have been able to rewrite some of the way that RubyGems parses TarGZ files. Like I don't know anything about TarGZ files. And then I just looked at how the code that already did it worked. And I see, oh, okay, well, I don't understand like this chunk, but I get the chunk that's below it. Like that makes sense. And then one of the things that I feel works the best for me for working on code is just to start refactoring it a little bit. Like if you feel like it's not organized right, you can refactor things and you can organize it how you think you would. And you can just throw it away after. Like, you'll understand the code a lot better. You might break the tests and then you're like, oh, I see why that was that way. That makes sense. And you'll come out of it with a lot better understanding. So if you feel this desire to contribute to something, if you use something and if it has a problem in it, you want to fix it, just go and take a look at what that code looks like. And it may be more approachable than you thought it would be at first. And it may be that when you pick around at it, you actually, maybe it's more workable than you thought. And if you make a PR and it's totally wrong, I think it's a rare open source maintainer that's going to be hard on you for making an actual contribution to a project. Making an attempt is hugely appreciated. And oftentimes, I think a lot of people will come in and make attempts and we will say, hey, this is good. You could put it right here and it would be a lot easier and maybe a little simpler. And then if you could just like maybe in this file, add a test, you can see there's other tests right here that are very similar. And so if you make it work just like that, then I think we're good and we can merge this.
Hello, it's me, Robbie, again. Just taking a quick moment to plug my own company, Planet Argon. Did you know that I run a company called Planet Argon? Planet Argon produces this podcast, Maintainable. We are a Ruby on Rails consultancy. We help companies modernize their Ruby on Rails applications. We like to help companies maintain their Rails applications. Hence, the topic, maintainable software, is kind of near and dear to my heart. So if you're interested in learning more, head over to planetargon.com. That's PlanetArgon, like the noble gas, .com. And now back to the show. I think that's some good advice for those listening that might be wanting to look for an open source project to contribute. I know every once in a while I'll get this kind of like spark of energy. I'm like, okay, I've got a couple hours. It's like a Friday afternoon. And I'm like, I'm gonna go look at one of these open source projects that I've used for a while and I'll just go take a poke at it. And one of the things I'll do is I'll go clone the project and be like, is there a test suite? How do I just get this thing up and running? Can I just get the test suite to pass? Or read the documentation that tells me how to set it up for your development environment. And quite often that usually results in like a pull request. Being like, I found some weird little thing, something's probably a little different now than the last time. And you know, when people are working on maintaining projects, they don't often have the benefit of having to go through it as a first-time user again. And so to like, I'm going to clean up the documentation. Like, you know, we always say that like whenever somebody comes into a company, like, oh, you can improve the documentation, but you can literally do that for open source stuff like all the time. I just follow their docs, or if there's no docs, add documentation, try to set up the application or try to run the gem test suite. Does it pass or not? And then if not, you know, that's a figure out if it's your local environment or help update the documentation so that you can get to that point. And then once you get to that point, then you can start poking around and feel like you know that if you break something, your test suite, you can see the test suite sweep. But I would always recommend trying to get the test suite to pass first so that you know you have at least you don't know if you broke it or if it was already broken when you first started it after you cloned the project. So
Yeah, indeed. Like, exactly that. Like, I love doing that, like contributing the, like, I tried to set up according to your instructions and it didn't work. And here's what actually worked for me. And yeah, and then once you have it running and your test suite actually works, I'll often have the, or is the test suite supposed to pass? that seems to be a really common occurrence. You're like, well, I ran it and almost all of it worked, but why didn't it fully pass? Is it expected that it fully passes, or are we in like a state where it's not right now?
Is this an issue with the computer I'm on? Is it the wrong hardware? Is this, you only have the test suite running in like a Linux environment and I'm on a Mac, or is this an M1 issue? A lot of variables, and that is a reality, but can also be a reason why people get quickly deterred. Like, wow, this is too complicated. Cause it definitely has happened to me where I'm just like, all right, I don't have time for this right now. I'll have to come back to some other day. And then every once in a while I'll go look, and I have this one folder of projects that I've cloned, and I'm like, oh yeah, I haven't touched that in 3 years. I tried to one evening and it just didn't, I didn't get that far. So, but it always means to try to contribute to those things. Well, I know that we could probably go into a lot of topics related to this, but I want to be mindful of our time. So I have a couple of quick last questions for you, Martin. First off, is there a non-technical book that you often recommend to colleagues in our industry?
Oh, you know what? I'm gonna fall back on just one of my favorite books ever. And that is Project Hail Mary. I think if you're technical like me, you'll just love that book. Oh, you haven't heard of Project Hail Mary? Oh my gosh, it's Andy Weir. It's the author of The Martian. I just love this book, and I got it for my son as well on audiobook, and he just listens to it over and over again when he's going to bed. It's a great book. I just cannot speak too highly of it. It's amazing.
And where can listeners best follow your thoughts and ruminations about software development online?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I am not one of those people who publishes very much online. So, like, most of my work has gone into the code on RubyGems. And so if you wanted to find me or contact me or reach out to me about something, you can go to martinmd.com. And I have a few like connections for how to get a hold of me, but I just a while ago stopped really posting on socials. I just don't really do it much anymore. So more power to you if you do. It's just, it's like one of those things that got lost as I'm, you know, dealing with kids instead of having all this free time.
I can appreciate that. Well, it's been such a delight having you join us on Maintainable, Martin. Thank you so much for stopping by to talk shop about Ruby, Ruby Central, Bundler, RubyGems, internals, and some of your favorite books.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, Robbie. This was really fun.